Okay, so this Dvar Torah actually Rabbi Galler shared by internet, maybe even in the shul a few years back, but I really did like it, so I saved it and then sent it to myself, and it came. Last year I sent it to myself also, but it came like 4 weeks after. I guess when you set it the year before, like you're just kind of guessing when it's gonna come. So I looked at the calendar this past year and it's like I'm gonna get it right. Okay, so let's take a look at the first source. So the Jewish people get the Torah in Parshat Yitro, but what's interesting is that there's almost like a second giving of the Torah in Perek Chav Dalet, because after we have all of Mishpatim and the technical laws and everything like that, so then there is the Nasa v'Nishma and everything else. Right, most of us assume the Nasa v'Nishma happened in Yitro because it's a natural story to accompany the Torah itself, but not in fact the case. I did hear this week an interesting idea by Rabbi Goldberg that historically, at some point or another, Mishpatim was actually two parshiot. There was the first part, and then there was the second part, which kind of makes sense because they really are two completely different stories. But be it as it may, we have one long parsha now. So let's take a look at the first source. So Moshe called Devrei Hashem. So Moshe wrote all the words of the Torah down. Vayashkem baboker, and he got up early in the morning. Vayiven mizbeach tachat ahar, and he built the mizbeach underneath the mountain. Yisrael, and there are 12 stones corresponding to the 12 shvatim. Okay, so parim. So he sends the Narei Bnei Yisrael, the young people of Israel, probably the young Bechorim, and they bring Korbanos, Olos, and Zvachim, and Shlamim to Hashem, all Parim. Vekach Moshe Chatzi Adam. So Moshe takes half the blood, Vayasem Ba'aganot, and he puts them in these basins. Vechatzi Adam, Zarak al Mizbeach. And the other half he throws on the Mizbeach. Vekach Sefer Brit, he takes the Torah, Vayikra b'yaznei ha'am, and he reads it to the people. Vayomru kol asher diber Hashem nasa v'nishma. Everything that Hashem has asked us to do, nasa v'nishma, we will do and we will listen. This, by the way, is like it's a tough one, because if you read the pasuk, it does not sound like the story we're familiar with. Right? The story we're familiar with is that God comes to the Jewish people and says, "Hey, do you want the Torah?" And the Jewish people are like, "Yep, Nasa v'Nishma." That's in contrast to all the nations of the world who say to Hashem, "Well, we're not disinterested, but please tell us what's written in it." So here, the pasuk actually doesn't say that. What the Jewish people hear the Torah, and then after they hear it, their answer is Nasa v'Nishma. So that is definitely what to think about. An interesting idea, I think I heard this from Rabbi Rubel, might have shared this before, is the idea is that the Jewish people heard the Torah, but they didn't understand the Torah, and maybe that's even more noble. You know, to take a document and say, okay, whatever's written here I'll do, is you know, pretty impressive. But to take it, to have read it, to understand some of it and not really understand it, and be like, okay, fine, I'll do it. That's even more, I don't know if you want to use the word impressive or crazy, but something along those lines. Yeah, David, what's up?
Yeah, I think we think differently. I think someone who's chiyav in a mitzvah gets more credit than someone who volunteers for a mitzvah. And you can apply the same sort of thinking here. If they did understand it and they accepted it and do it, that's better than they heard it, they didn't understand it, and they said they would do it.
Uh-huh.
I think it's what he's saying.
I hear.
Are you saying the same thing?
No, I don't think that's what he... I don't think
No,
that's
I think David's saying that...
It's a surprise. Like, intuitively, it sounds like someone who volunteers for something is better than someone who's required, but I don't think that's antithetical to how we actually believe.
Right, I think... So then what was Michael saying?
But I'm saying the opposite. I'm saying that it's more impressive...
To take something unseen...
Right.
I thought you were going the other way.
Yeah, no, sorry. I'm happy that that both of you got to clarify. Yeah, to me, like, if you sign up for a job and you have no idea what you're getting yourself into, like, that, I don't know if impressive is the right word, but it's like crazier. Like, why?
It's a show of faith.
Yeah, I don't disagree with the notion. I'm not saying like this is David Barrett's stand. I think what you're saying sounds better. Like if you found, mm-hmm. yeah, I agree with you conceptually, but at the end of the day, it's good. We can keep going.
Do we know what day this is? Do we know when this is?
That's a good question. It would be presumably after they got the Torah.
The day after? I mean, I'm just trying to go back to the first pasuk because, like, let's say we got the Torah on the 6th. So Moshe stayed up that day, wrote it all down, went to sleep, got up the next morning, so the 7th. Both this is Berach and this is all going on the 7th.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I'm going to quickly take a look and see in the Chumash.
What are you getting at? What day it is?
No, I was just trying. I was trying out the timeline because it's Vayichta Moshe as Kogavay Hashem, right? He goes to sleep. Vayashkei Maboker. I was just wondering, no, if this is like immediately, like you got the Torah and then he wrote it immediately, and
so that implies that you know, the simplistic thinking, like, you know, where I really always regard, you know, like what we learned in third grade. I was thinking, like, on the 6th, he got the Aseret Dibrot, and then over time, Hashem explained in the entirety.
Yeah, like a couple of weeks or whatever.
But this is your question is a good one. It makes you think, did he get the whole thing from Bereishis to the end of the book on that one day? I don't know.
So actually, Rashi and many of the other Mefarshim say that this is pre-Matan Torah. Rashi says that this is Kodem Aseres HaDibros, Ve'arbas B'Sivan, on the 4th day of Sivan. And then obviously the question would be, what's Vayichtov Moshe? What did Moshe write to them? So he writes, Rashi says, Mibereshit Vad Matan Torah, V'kata Mitzvah Shin Tztavu B'Mara, from Bereshit to Matan Torah, and the mitzvos that were given in Mara. So it's interesting. I'll give a plug. Eitan Auerbach has a weekly Dvar Torah that he sends out. It's like 3 minutes long. You can ask Shmuel to send it to you, or you could ask Eitan to put you on his distribution. I won't lie, I always listen to it a week later because he sends it out after Shabbos. So usually the next Friday, I'm like, oh man, I didn't get to it. But on Parshas B'Shalach, so he said that at Mara we got the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nei Noach and three other mitzvos. He quotes a medrash on that. So I actually said to him, I was like, that's amazing because that comes out to the number 10. I was like, so it seems like in Mara they got, and you could like correspond the mitzvos actually. I think to a certain extent to the Aseres HaDibros, I said it seems like both of them are like it's a mini. His idea was something anyway connected to Matan Torah, but I was like, I think that that's such. I think that's the message of the 10. Why did the Medrash pick 10 and not 11 or 9? Because Mara is like a mini Har Sinai, which could explain a lot. But yeah, that's I apologize. It seems like most of the Mefarshim say the opposite. I'm assuming that you'll get at least one that will say that it is after, because in order for this to happen before, you have to believe in the concept of Ein Mukdam Meuchar Batorah. And there are a few Mefarshim that really like just reject Ein Mukdam Meuchar Batorah straight out. So they're going to have to kind of get around that. But yeah, okay, so that does change things. So what happened?
I just answered, David asked, you know, why, what am I getting at? This sounds like a pretty big yomtiv. I mean, if you go back to the Nasa Vinishra and you go and you parallel the Purim, Kibble be Kiblu, I mean, that was always the parallel between the two, that this was not done Baratzon and Purim was done Baratzon, right? Those are pretty remarkable days. Purim, Kiyom, Kippurim. This would have been a pretty impressive day. You bring all these carbonos, you are Mikabel Torah verbally in a pretty big way. It should be a marked day. And that's what I was kind of asking, like, when is it? Because if it's the day after Shavuos, or the second day of Shavuos is the Minei Chutzlah, it's holds, that works. But if it's the fourth day of Sivan, we don't do anything special on the fourth day of Sivan. We don't mark it.
We don't say Kachnu.
We don't say Kachnu.
Yeah, and if it's a Monday, if it's, yeah, certainly if it's a Monday or a Thursday, it's a big deal.
Yeah, but it's the 3 days. It's the 3 days that we don't say. It's not just the fourth. It's the beginning of the 3 days. But anyway, that's where I was coming from.
Right, I hear. Yeah, I mean, I guess in general, like, even if they accept it, what does that mean that they accept it? Do they really have a choice to accept it? Like, I don't, the whole tachted ahar with the mountain over their head part is, like, very hard to really, like, wrap your head around. It's unlikely that that's actually happened. But what are they going to say? If they're saying no to God, what's going to happen? They're in the middle of the desert with no provisions other than the fact that God is providing them right now with food and water. They're not going to say no, so they're stuck. But yeah, I hear what you're saying. But anyway, either way, the fact is that still Nasa v'Nishma is not as impressive when there's something accompanied to it. Meaning, like, to me, to say Nasa v'Nishma to a completely, like, I don't know what God is going to say to me, right? That's like when someone comes to you, I guess, like, the best example would be someone comes to you and says, hey, I need you to do me a big favor. Can you do it? And you're like, okay. Well, what does that mean? Like, there's a, the range of big favors are pretty broad. So what is it exactly that you're agreeing to? That's the difference, as opposed to where if you got to hear what was said in Mara, and you get to hear some of the Torah already, then at least you have a flavor of what you're agreeing to. All right, Pasuk Chet. Ekach Moshe et Adam ve'zor kol Adam ve'yomer hinei Adam ha'brit asher karta Hashem lechem. Al kolad v'rim eile. So Moshe says to them, okay, Moshe takes the blood, he sprinkles it on them, he says, this is the blood of the covenant which God has made with you, and on these words. Ayal Moshe v'Aaron Nadav Aviv v'shivim zekenei Yisrael. So Moshe, Aaron Nadav Aviv, and the zekenim go up. This is a very hard pasuk to understand. So, and they see the God of Israel, and underneath his feet is a, I believe the English translation is a lattice work of sapphire, but probably an easier translation would be brick, a sapphire brickwork. And it is like the essence of the heavens in purity. It's a very pure blue color underneath the feet of God that look like sapphire bricks. And to these people of Israel, God did not do anything to them, and they looked at God and they ate and they drank. So Rashi says, "What's velatzile b'nei Yisrael?" So those are the leaders, and the leaders weren't killed here because God didn't want to ruin the day, especially if this is pre-Matan Torah. Could you imagine if God had killed these people on the fourth day? The Torah being given 2 days later would be given in such a different state. So God says, all right, I'm going to hold off on it. And then God kills them later on. Okay, so the two questions that I want to try to understand is, first of all, how does Livnatus appear in this whole thing connect to the story? What does this add? And beyond that, what is it? Right? What are they looking at? So Rashi says, "Can I say Livnatus appear? He aita lefana b'shara shibud." That even during the work, right, even during the years of slavery, this brick was in front of them. This core, and therefore now. So the brick somehow was looming over them for all of these years, and now that God is giving them the Torah, the brick is still there. And so what's it doing? It's reminding them of the suffering that they had gone through. They were freed, they were redeemed, there was light and happiness in front of them. Uka'etzem, ketargumu l'shom maretz, the appearance, latoar l'shom barur v'tzalul. It's clear and pristine. So this is the ultimate Jewish idea, right? In the midst of all of our suffering, we believe that God is there. But even in our redemption, we believe that we need to reflect and to share the suffering that we sustained. You could find lots of Jewish practice like that. You know, to me, the one that pops out most is the fact that at the chuppah, the happiest moment in a couple's life, right, and especially the way we do it, right, after Shavuot Brachos, and after we're at that moment when we're about to dance, What happens? We break the cup and we sing Yimeshkachech. Why do we do that? And in some cases, we put ashes on the head of the chasen. And there are places in Israel that try, although I think it's hard because now they're kept under lock and key. But for a long time, people would try to go into places, the burnt house in Jerusalem, one of them, and they would take actual ashes from the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, and they would try to sprinkle that on the head of the chasen. Okay, so but it makes sense. Why? Because that's Judaism, right? When we're really really happy, there is a touch of our sadness because life is not what it should be, could be, and all that. Okay, we're good. Makes sense. Okay, so let's take a look at the Chizkuni. Chizkuni has a different take on it. So he says davar acher livnes apir l'shon livne. So he points out that it's a brick. Amr Bikiva, Avde Parway Docha Kim Umakan Isal Kilaso Lem Tochen Levanian Bekefel. At the very end, or actually not necessarily at the very end, but the Avde Paro always rushed the Jewish people to make the number of bricks. There was a quota, and you had to fulfill your quota every single day. Bekefesh Nemar, Tochen Levanim, Titnuba Mitsim, Loa Yu Notnilam Tevin, and at the end, right, the Jewish people did not even get straw to make the bricks. They had to go out to the desert to look for straw. And of course, the straw that they found were full of thorns. And it would cut their feet. So the blood would be mixed into the bricks. Which, by the way, really explains what piece of the Seder?
The stuff we did the Marah into.
Yeah, the Charoset, right? It's just funny. Like, you always wonder, like, what does the wine have to do with the Charoset? Yes, the Charoset looks like bricks. Right? It has that, the same, or not bricks, it looks like cement. Right, if you've seen cement and you've seen charoset, often, like they have the same grayish color. Why do we add the grape juice, the wine into it? And I think there are some that have the custom to add in the wine in dafka right at that moment. Meaning, it's not that it's part. It's not that it's just an ingredient, but as you're about to do the charoset, you pour it in then. So the question would be, why would you do that? But according to the Chizkuni, it makes total sense because that's what it's supposed to look like and it's supposed to remind you of the blood that was mitboseis umitarei batit. So if you remember this, come Seder time, you have a nice Chizkuni to share. Rachel bat beno shel metushelach haita. And Rachel, who is the granddaughter of metushelach, haita hara la ledet. She was she was pregnant to give birth. Romeset batit im bala, and she was working in the cement with her husband. Achiyatsa havlad mimeyeha until she gave birth. Vinitarevim hamal bain, and the child that came out of her, right? No epidural. This was a natural pregnancy. Went way quicker than she thought. The kid fell into the malbein, into the brick. By tatzo eket al benav al tatzak atalifne kisei akavod. And she was crying, and her cries went out to the ribono shel olam. If anybody uses the picture Haggadah by Rabbi Chait, right? It's a two page spread of her, this woman, like with her hands up in the air, crying. Because she just gave birth, and her kid ends up in the actual mix and becomes a brick. So what happens? The Arad Michael v'natluhu v'alu l'fnei kisei hakavod. So Michael the Malach comes down and takes that brick up to God. And then puts it underneath the feet of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who shenemar v'tachat raglav kimasei livnat hasapir, perush levanash and nasei mishapir hayoledet. So the Chizkuni plays around with the wording here. I don't know if you're going to like this. Everything is good until you get to the end. He says, underneath his feet is kimasei livnat hasapir. Livnat is a brick. And Shapir, right, with a shin, is a, not a feet. I don't think it's a fetus, but maybe I'm wrong. But that's what is the child that came out was in the brick. So obviously the only problem is that Chizkuni ignores the fact that it's spelled differently. And Sapir is sapphire, and Shapir is the afterbirth.
Wasn't Shin and Samach, or I guess Sin and Samach, like there's sets of letters that are somewhat interchangeable.
Yeah, but it's not like even Sapir, I believe it's Shapir.
I know.
All right. Anyway, that's another possibility. Now, what's interesting is historically, this would then be, this brick was not with them the whole time. This brick came at what? At the very end, right? Right before the Jewish people come out, that is when Rachel bat beno shel Metushelach has this kid. I also find it fascinating. We'd have to look at where this medrash comes from. That of all the names that she, right? Because Rachel is, her name and her grandfather's name are likely just, you know, made up names of the medrash. But Rachel mevakal banaha, Rachel the crier, is the one, and her father, or grandfather rather, is Metushelach, right? Named after the oldest person that ever was recorded in Tanakh. So yeah, I don't know what you do with that, but if you find the answer to that, let me know. Okay, so this is quite a fascinating nevuah. It's quite a fascinating story. This Livnat HaSapir. What's interesting is it is not the only time in Tanakh that we have that. At the very beginning of Yechezkel has his famous vision, the Ma'aseh Merkava, which is the vision that is so very difficult to understand. We have no idea what he's talking about. And at the very end of it, it says, "Mala Rakia Shel Rosham," and on top of the Rakia, which is on top of their head, came out, which is interesting because here the perspective is different. The perspective is not Tachat Raglav, but it is Mimal Rosham. But it's in the same place because it's underneath the feet of God. Kemarei Evan Sapir Dmut Kisei, V'al Dmuta Kisei Dmut Kemarei Adam Alav Milmala. So there is Mare'e Evan Sapir. There is the vision of a sapphire stone, which is a Dmut, an image of a chair. And on the chair, on the throne, is a vision, like a person on top of it. So we have a similar sapir, a similar sapphire. And here the only difference is that, and it's under Hashem. Now you could probably sit there and say, let's figure out what are the similarities between the story. But rather than doing that, because there are certainly similarities, we're up by God and we have sapphire, we could ask the question, what are the differences? So what are some of the differences? I pointed out one is that the perspective is different. Anything else?
Yeah, Livnat and Evan. One's man-made and one's natural-made.
Okay, good. Anything else? Okay, so let's go with the perspective and with the ingredients of what it's made of. So let's take a look at the Malbim. The Malbim says, "Hu atzmo masharei Yechezkel k'marei Evan Sapir Dmuki say Rakshe Yechezkel raya k'marei Evan v'heim ra'u k'maseh Livnat." So he says it like Sruli. It's not the same story. One, the Jewish people see Livnat, see bricks, and Yechezkel sees stone. Sheish hevdel ben Evan uvein Livnat. There is a difference, a fundamental difference between stone and between brick. She Evan mitaveh betaveloi de'masa b'nei Adam. That the stone lives in nature, and it's not created by man. And bricks are made out of man-made material, right? Even the story of the Chizkuni, the Medrash with Rachel, Bat Beno Shel Metushelach, could not possibly exist in the world of a stone, right? The baby would not have been able to become part of the stone, whereas by a brick, it's man-made material, it's possible. Because when Yechezkel sees this Ma'aseh Merkava, nothing that he's doing, nothing that he's seeing is in the world or is existing in a in the time of nature. He was seeing not the way the world was run, but he was seeing a vision of the world. It is therefore done in a way that is similar to a stone that has no part of man in it. But when the Zkenim saw the vision in their time, they were seeing in a miraculous way the way God works in this world. Therefore, they see it as a brick which is man-made. Why does this generation get to see something so amazing? It's because of what they had endured, right? What they endured was so great that therefore they deserved God's vision. They said, and therefore they were purified and deserved this opportunity. When God is working in a completely miraculous way, and that time it does not come upon man. So what the Malbim is saying beautifully is that what the Jewish people are seeing here is not exactly the same thing as Yechezkel. They're seeing the experience in Mitzrayim, which was therefore their zchus to see the miraculous nature of how God works. The experience in Mitzrayim creates bricks and helps them get out. Not so by Yechezkel, because by Yechezkel, no man has no part in it. They'll totally require Hashem to get them out. The message that the Malbim is telling us is that the struggle wasn't for nothing. The Jewish people struggled mightily in Egypt. What's going to happen to them? They built something. They built bricks. And those bricks are what led ultimately to the Geula. It seems like a generation that suffers so greatly gets to see a Geula in such an unbelievable way. I don't want to, it's not my place to say that this is definitively the case, but you could definitely make a comparison historically to the generation that of our grandparents, that the generation post-Holocaust, or maybe our parents, right? So that generation went through something that was so horrible, and yet the Geula that they saw not that long after, the fact that the Jewish people came back to Israel after 1900 plus years of being Gaulis, I think is something that is nothing short of remarkable. But it seems like the Malbim is laying out that when a generation suffers so mightily, then they have to see a vision with such clarity that the suffering that they endured was not for naught, but rather it was creating that which will redeem them. So I thought that perhaps what the Malbim is telling us is that the day-to-day struggle that we go through, those are bricks. And hopefully when we suffer in our day-to-day things, it'll amount to something. It's hard for us to suffer and then not see that what happened was for the best. Meaning like when we have something really bad or something really challenging that happens to us, what we want most to see is that really it was paving the way for Geula. So that's the day-to-day struggles. But the collective suffering by Bnei Yisrael, right, the real tragedies and the real stuff that the Jewish people go through, it's different. And that, like Yechezkel's nevuah, requires avanim. We need so much help from God to redeem us. That, to me, though, if you look at it that way, that's really, that is really, really depressing. So perhaps a different way of looking at it is that it's our opportunity. The collective suffering of the Jewish people is our opportunity to build towards the final geula. And we have to understand that in order to get there, it requires tremendous work. But hopefully that work is worth it. And through that, the Jewish people will ultimately see the redemption. Have a wonderful Shabbos.